Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, as usual. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Gary Weiss, author of a new book on Ayn Rand, Her Cult, and Her Influence in American Politics, which, thanks first to Alan Greenspan and then the Tea Party, has been huge. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from a frequent guest in this show, Adolph Reed, talking about Black History Month, the rehabilitation of the ghoulish Charles Murray, and politics these days. Time is very short, so not much time for a commentary. I just want to say a few words about Greece, about which more next week. Just a few observations until then. One, it's clear that if there's a conflict between democracy and creditor power, democracy loses. The first modern instance of this was the 1975 New York City fiscal crisis, in which the elected government was essentially replaced by a committee of bankers who oversaw an austerity plan that protected bondholder interests. Here we are, 37 years later, and the same structure is being applied to Greece. The head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, has pronounced the European social model, a gentler way of doing capitalism, dead. And unless there's massive popular resistance to that agenda, the bankers will have their way. But the thing is, the Greek austerity plan is unsustainable. There's no way that the Greek economy can survive this round of bloodletting. The Eurodrama is far from over. Back to talk Ayn Rand after a musical break. That was a bit of the third movement of the second piano sonata by Dmitri Shostakovich, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazy. More of that sort of thing at the half-hour mark. My first guest is Gary Weiss, author of Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul, just out from St. Martin's. Rand was once a marginal figure, even on the American right, but her influence and visibility have grown enormously in recent years, and paradoxically even more so since the outbreak of the financial crisis in 2008. You might think that the anything-goes philosophy of her early and still loyal acolyte Alan Greenspan, a philosophy that contributed enormously to the disaster, might have discredited her and her mode of thought, but alas, anything but. Gary Weiss was a reporter for Business Week from 1986 to 2004 and has written for many other business publications. This is his third book, Gary Weiss. Welcome, Gary. So how did you get interested in the strange topic of Ayn Rand?
Originally, I was going to be taking a look at Alan Greenspan and his role in the horribleness that we've encountered over the past few years. But the more I looked into Greenspan, the more I realized that it's really Ayn Rand. I mean, Ayn Rand was the godmother of the right. She was, Alan Greenspan was a huge advocate of Rand's. He was an associate of Rand's for 30 years. It all kind of comes back to Rand.
Funnily enough, when he took over at the Fed back in 87, I called the Fed's press office for a comment on his history with Rand. They immediately patched me through to their chief publicist, instead of just having some low-level flack taken on the question. And he had, of course, had no comment, and I said, has anybody called, anybody else called to ask this question? He said, not at all. So apparently there was no interest in Greenspan's Randian past at that point.
Yeah, it was known, but Rand was off the radar screen back in the 80s. she really wasn't, you know, she's been sort of a subliminal impact on the American dialogue for many years. You know, she's been there, and, you know, she's got these best-selling books, but people haven't just really appreciated how important she is in the revival of the right that we have nowadays.
Also, funnily enough, you know, from my past, I was a right-winger in college in the early 70s, and back in the Party of the Right looked askance at Rand, and we followed the National Review line. She was not popular with Buckley's circle, was she?
No. They hated her. They hated her because of her opposition to Christianity and her opposition to Judeo-Christian values. And, you know, as I've found is that, you know, if one wants to counter Rand, you know, it's true that the conservatives on the right, you know, some of the religious right don't like Rand. But, you know, Judeo-Christian values have some many life-affirming aspects to them. And I think that as one examines Rand from an oppositional standpoint, one really needs to sort of embrace, you know, Judeo-Christian values and also the values of the Founding Fathers, which are in opposition to Rand. Definitely opposition to Rand.
You make the point in the book that left liberals, opponents of Rand's, or just general left liberal people in politics, avoid questions of morality and principle and basic philosophy, and the Randians are obsessed with this, right?
Yes, they're very much into examining the morality of capitalism. You know, I mean, in Rand, you know, she made it moral to be selfish. That's what her whole philosophy is about. You know, she made it moral to be selfish. She made it cool to be selfish.
And she wasn't kidding.
No. She was not kidding at all.
And she has a selective dictionary definition of selfishness, right?
Yeah, she defines selfishness in a way that nobody else defines it. In order to make selfishness more palatable, she sort of distorted the dictionary definition of selfishness.
In what way?
Well, she said that selfishness, I mean, the way she defined it is if you're selfless. I mean, the way most people learn selflessness in nursery school is that, you know, you want to be nice to others. But she defines selflessness as sacrifice, you know, that you're sacrificing, that, you know, that a husband will rather you know, save the life of a stranger than save the life of his wife. You know, that's her definition of selflessness. No one else defines selflessness that way. And she built her whole philosophy on this distorted definition of selfishness.
Now, about her, there were a small circle of acolytes. Give us the history of her and how the doctrine spread. Let's go back to the early days. Who were the inner circle?
The inner circle of Rand, in the Rand group, in beginning in the early 50s, were people that she knew through a man by the name of Nathaniel Brandon and his wife, Barbara Brandon. I mean, they got to know, these were a young couple from Canada originally, and they had gotten to know Rand when she was living in California. You know, she was very prominent in the late 40s because of this book, The Fountainhead. The Fountainhead was a very, very popular bestseller in the 1940s. It basically puts forth her philosophy of selfishness. And Rand, in the early 50s, surrounded herself with people who were like-minded, people like Brandon. It became sort of a cult. And one of the earliest members of her cult, one of the most prominent members of her cult, was Alan Greenspan.
And the broader society was not at all interested in Rand at that point, was it?
No, she was a popular author. You know, the Fountainhead was made into a movie with Gary Cooper. It's a pretty good movie, I think so. Well, didn't get very good reviews. She was a popular author, but her philosophy was viewed as a bit of a wacko philosophy, and the right did not really accept her. Back in the 50s, as you pointed out, Bill Buckley couldn't stand her because she rejected, you know, the usual standards of Western civilization. You know that you want to be selfless and kind to people, and she was opposed to that.
But then Whitaker Chambers had that famous piece, which he denounced her as an authoritarian. There was something about her that said, "To the gas chamber, go."
Well, what happened was that Whitaker Chambers was assigned by Bill Buckley to write a review of her book, Atlas Shrugged. Atlas Shrugged came out in the late 50s. And just as The Fountainhead set forth her philosophy of selfishness and why it's good to be selfish, Atlas Shrugged focused on free market capitalism. And her aim was to show that, you know, everything that people had generally been feeling was incorrect about capitalism, you know, basically the workers were exploiting the bosses, that common people really didn't matter much. What mattered in society were the moguls, were what you call the creators. Common people she viewed as almost subhuman. And as a result, you had in the book a scene, which Whitaker Chambers latched onto, where people who she viewed as sort of subhuman or who warranted death were caught on a train in a tunnel and were gassed to death because of a faulty mechanism in the locomotive. And it became almost a gas chamber. And in effect, you had Ayn Rand gassing her enemies, gassing people she felt didn't deserve to live.
A lot of more mainstream or less extreme conservatives look to religion as a way of tempering the extremes of the market. I think the relation between the market libertarians and the religious folks on the right is not always an easy one, but you know they would say that that religion would give people the kind of charitable impulses that might be missing in a pure, unfettered market society, but Rand would have none of that.
Now, Rand was basically opposed to charity. She did not feel that people had an obligation to charity. And that's the difference between her and people on the religious right. You know, say what you will about people on the religious right. Of course, they're virulently opposed to abortion, whereas Rand was in favor of abortion. You know, there's some interesting little quirks in her philosophy which appeal to people. However, Rand was virulently opposed to charity and helping the poor, and the religious right or people in religious people do feel that there is an obligation to help the poor, which Rand eliminated from her philosophy. She was opposed to the Christian doctrine, the Judeo-Christian doctrine of helping the poor.
And she also had a beef with libertarians. This gets a little arcane, she was as much into internal doctrinal battles as any kind of Trotskyist cult, wasn't she?
Absolutely. She did not like libertarians at all. She really hated libertarians. She felt that they ripped off her ideas. But it was really kind of just a territoriality. You know, she didn't like people encroaching on her turf. That's really all that came down to. Libertarians loved her. She didn't like them at all.
But didn't she also object to a certain hippie-ish cast to them in the 60s and early 70s?
Yeah, you know, originally libertarians were sort of, they called them the hippies of the right. She felt that they were sort of more anarchists than anything else, and she was opposed to anarchists. But I think at bottom it just came down to territoriality. I mean, these people really, the libertarians are very similar to Rand in many respects, and they adapted Rand to a broader audience. But she wouldn't have that. She did not believe in appealing to a broader audience. She wanted people to adopt all of her views. She did not like people. She was against Reagan. Reagan was in many respects a Randian, but Reagan had this alliance with the religious right. So she opposed Reagan.
Back in my days in the right in the early 70s, we were a small minority, but even within that small minority, only a very small minority liked Rand at all. So how did she go from being a minority taste within a minority to having such a broad influence?
What happened was that after her death, you know, at the time of her death in 1982, she was just isolated and of no significance. You know, the Rand movement self-destructed in the 70s, because anyone who had liked Rand, all of her, with the exception of Alan Greenspan, pretty much, the Rand movement was just disintegrated. Rand expelled people. It was, as you pointed out, it was almost like the Soviets to a large extent, or the Stalinists. Then there being internal purges within the Rand movement. But then what you had in the 90s, as the Rand, you had something called the Ayn Rand Institute was created, you had Randian groups that began to expand the appeal of Rand. And Rand's appeal in the 90s up to the present day has been through her novels, has been through Atlas Shrugged, it's been through The Fountain, but mainly Atlas Shrugged. Atlas Shrugged, you know, popularizes the whole concept of free market capitalism. You know, it's basically a propaganda book, a very well written, in my opinion, it's a much better written book than is generally considered. It's fairly good popular fiction. It popularized the concept of free market capitalism. It made free market capitalism acceptable to a large audience. It glossed over the detrimental effects of free market capitalism and laissez-faire. And it was basically Atlas Shrugged, the revival of Atlas Shrugged, that revived Rand's philosophy.
I'm speaking with Gary Weiss, author of Ayn Rand Nation, just out from St. Martin's. But also the you know, the temper of the times changed. You know, she died in 82. That's when the bull market in stocks took off. The 80s became the roaring 80s. There was the Reagan years. So the general society moved to the right. So she certainly took it. Her memory certainly was enhanced by that.
Yeah, when you had the you know, the revival in the market resulted in you know, a revival in the whole concept of capitalism as being the be-all and end-all of American society. But it was a situation where the Randians, like Alan Greenspan, became very powerful. Alan Greenspan transmitted Rand's views into the upper echelons of government. So I call him the Murray Hill candidate. You know, he was almost programmed at an early age to disseminate Rand's views in government. Obviously, not all of them, but to the extent that he could, he made Rand's views on, you know, disseminating and destroying regulations. He made Rand's views into government policy to the best of his ability. And Rand became popular. I think the surge in popularity that we're seeing for Rand, that is a large extent taken place since the financial crisis of 2008, because the right has sort of twisted the facts. They've rewritten history, and they've twisted the facts of the financial crisis to make it into a government-caused problem and not a problem that was caused by the banks. It's been sort of a rewriting of history that's really quite a remarkable thing that we're seeing played out.
A lot of your book is taken up by your travels amidst the objectivists of today. Tell us what things look like in that subculture.
Well, Lorraine culture, it's really kind of interesting. I found that Randians are all over the lot. Now, they vary from Tea Party people, individuals who've, you know, some of the leaders of the Tea Party movement are Randians. It hasn't come out publicly, but, you know, most of the leaders of the Tea Party are Randians, people who have read Rand's books and who adhere to the majority of her philosophy. You have Tea Party people. You have groups of Randians meeting all over. They're, you know, they vary from you know, Tea Party groups to you know, Northeastern intellectuals. It's a little bit like you know, the left. I think it's a little bit like the left in the old days when you know, the new left had a cadre of true believers, very focused ideological people, surrounded by groups of what you know, used to be known in the old days as fellow travelers. You know, the Randians call them fellow travelers. You know, people who agree with a great deal of what they believe in. And the Tea Party, you see that, and you see how the ideologically committed have driven the Tea Party. They pushed the Republican Party over to the right. It's the Tea Party driving the Tea Party. It's the Randers driving the Tea Party and the Tea Party driving the Republican Party.
But the Tea Party people you spoke with had a real difficult time articulating their grievances.
What I found was that the Tea Party people, the ones even that are motivated by Rand, you know, they have a vague dissatisfaction with what's going on in the United States. And they're struggling to relate it to Rand. But Rand is basically the motivator of a lot of what they're thinking. And Rand, by making capitalism popular, Rand is sort of is at the bottom of a great deal of their thinking.
When you were talking to these folks, you were trying to address the Tom Frank question, what's the matter with Kansas? Why people who are certainly not rich, these are not, you know, the hedge funders of the world who would materially benefit from an Ayn Rand philosophy, you really couldn't find much of an answer as to what was in it for them, could you?
No, I could not. And I think that's one of the things that ways that, in fact, Rand can be counteracted is that, you know, Rand believed that people should act in their own rational self-interest. And, well, there's nothing really wrong with that concept in and of itself if you don't take all the other baggage that you put in with it. So I think people have to think, you know, is it in my rational self-interest to destroy the government quite the way Rand wants it to be destroyed? And I think that the people in the Tea Party or the people on the right don't always go through that mental exercise. You know, is it in my interest to adapt the Randian philosophy?
Now, after the financial crisis, Greenspan did some congressional testimony, and there were photos of him looking just utterly pained and anguished. And I recall he said something that there's just no room in his understanding or his philosophy for what happened. He, for a second or two, seemed to undergo some kind of reappraisal, but when his memoirs came out Not much sign of that?
No, there was really no sign of that. Memoirs came out at about the time of his so-called mea culpa in Congress. His memoirs came out in 2007, and he downplayed his entire association with Rand. In 2008, when you had the congressional testimony over the financial crisis, and Greenspan delivered what they call his flaw speech, where he talked about a flaw in his thinking, which a lot of people, including a lot of the Randians, felt was a repudiation of Rand. But if you examine that statement, if you examine the statements that Greenspan made at the time, he never really repudiated Rand. And as a matter of fact, to this day, he has reaffirmed his faith in Rand. You know, he just gave up what I would call a public relations gesture of contrition and reassessment. But he didn't really mean it. And if you study the things that he said at that time, the things that he said in that very appearance before Congress, you find that he just immediately took back what he said.
What you just said, there's a lot of religious language. You said faith, you said contrition. There are aspects of the religious cult about the Randians, isn't there?
No question about it. Among the inner circle, there is even to this day almost a cult-like aspect to Rand. But I think that Rand is much less of a cult than she might have been in the 1950s. And I think that the people at the Ayn Rand Institute, I think, have been, they're very smart people. And they have, I think, although there are these cult-like aspects, they have nevertheless gone beyond the early days and have done a really good job of making Rand palatable to a larger number of people. You know, they've sort of disguised a bit her atheism. Her atheism is enormously, it's one of the obstacles that prevents Rand from being accepted by the people on the right, the religious right, obviously. And they've sort of disguised that. They've done a really good job of making Rand less of a religion than they might have been than she was in the past.
And although she was, and most of her followers are virulently anti-statist, some of them have no problem with the military. They were enthusiastic supporters of the war in Iraq, many of them, right?
Yes, that's true. The Rand establishment at the Ayn Rand Institute were very much in favor of the war in Iraq. Their view is somewhat nuanced. I mean, they felt that if you're going to pursue this war, you know, you want to really destroy Iraq and take their oil. They're a little bit more toward neocons than most libertarians. You know, like the Ron Paul faction of the Republican Party. You know, they're against foreign entanglements. And so is Rand to a great extent, but they've also taken the position that the military, since we're involved in the war in Iraq, let's really go ahead and let's destroy them. And they take a more anti-Islamic position, for instance. The Randians take a very strongly anti-Islamic position, which is something that you don't see among many or most libertarians.
Yeah, and many of them are very much against the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, right?
Yes, that's true. There's no question. One of the biggest blogger against the Ground Zero Mosque, Pamela Geller, is very much a Randian, and as a matter of fact, the leader of the Rand movement, one of the leaders of the Rand movement, a former associate of Rand, Leonard Peikoff, he actually advocated bombing the Ground Zero Mosque. So you see a lot of that in the Rand, among Rand followers, which you don't see among libertarians in general.
How do you explain that? Where does it come from?
Well, I think it had to do a lot with Rand's own positions on the Middle East as they developed. You know, late in her life, she took a very pro-Israel position, a very anti-Arab position, and I think you're seeing that reflected. You know, Rand's followers generally try to act the way they think Rand would act in any given situation. You know, Rand had some very contradictory views on foreign policy. She was opposed, for instance, to entry into World War II. But yet, she never really spoke out on foreign policy all that much until the late 70s, where she began to give some TV appearances where she was very pro-Israel, which I think might have been related to the way the geopolitics was evolving at the time with, the Soviet Union being very anti-Israel. So that's, I think, probably why you see this very strongly anti-Islamic position being taken by members of the Randian establishment.
We touched on this a bit, but I just want to make this explicit. How do you explain the fact that coming after this
massive disaster of what most people would call unregulated capitalism, the number of followers of Rand seems to have expanded and their influence grown.
It's enormous. The Rand books have become are bestsellers again. They were bestsellers in 1958, and they're bestsellers again today. And I've seen a poll. The poll was conducted in 2009 by the Zogby Organization, a reputable polling group, which said that 29% of the American public had read Atlas Shrugged. And even if that's wrong by a factor of 50%, if it's 15%, that's still an enormous number. And so you have, first of all, the popularity of her books. Why are her books popular? They appeal to something deep within the American character, you know, real admiration of individuality. There are aspects to Rand which I view as sort of, they're almost like self-help books to a large extent. They really appeal to people on sort of a gut level that people should stand up for themselves. You see that in the books. But you also have, since the 2008 financial crisis, you've had a systematic rewriting of history. And this is not just in the Rand organization, but you also see this in the right in general. There's been a rewriting of the history of the financial crisis to turn this from a Wall Street crisis, a crisis created by the big banks on Wall Street, into a government-created crisis where government policies were responsible for the financial crisis. Because of this rewriting of history, Rand's beliefs have latched onto that. So therefore, we had a bailout. The bailout was required because the bailouts are very unpopular and they were dubious, but the bailouts were made necessary by the actions of the banks. In the rewriting of history, the bailouts were made necessary by the actions of the government. And that all shoehorns right in with Rand.
That was Gary Weiss, author of Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul, just out from St. Martin's. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk politics with Adolf Reed. That was some of the Spanish Dance from Dmitri Shostakovich's score for the movie The Gadfly, performed by Vladimir Ashkenazi. My next guest is Adolf Reed. Adolf is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. He's finishing up a book on Barack Obama and black politics, which will be published sometime soon by Verso. Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. I've been off the air for much of February, so I haven't had a chance to celebrate Black History Month. How have you been observing it?
I've mainly been observing it by not getting any invitations to speak anywhere for about the 10th year in a row. In fact, I was talking to Ken Warren about this. We've had the same experience. That's too personal. I mean, I don't think I would, I have no right to expect such. But, yeah, I'm not sure what to say about it at this point. I mean, when Carter G. Woodson started it I think the late teens or the early 20s, as Negro History Week, the idea was to draw attention to the accomplishments of blacks in American history and to counter, sort of conventional understanding that came from the likes of Thomas Dixon, right, about what black people in America were and had and hadn't done and thus what they deserved as claims on the regard of the political community. And, I mean, I recall when it expanded into a month. And
the shortest month of the year, though.
Well, that's true. It is the shortest one, which shows that racism is still alive. But a friend of mine observed at the time that he thought the material reason for the expansion was to maximize the opportunities that all those black poets and freelance race spokespersons had to maximize the revenue. Because for them, it's like Christmas season, right? They've got to pack it all into that month, or say really like the 2 weeks before, starting with the King holiday. So it's like Black History 6 weeks at this point. But you know, like everything else, right? The logic of this has taken its shape and become routinized under capitalism, just like everything else does. So there are speakers bureaus that provide laundry lists of acceptable speakers who give uplifting performances, right, of one sort or another. So that's what Black History Month is at this point.
Well, it seems to be part of the American celebration. I mean, it's about uplift and commercial exploitation and optimism and with a dash of Protestant religion thrown in.
Well, that's pretty much what it seems to be. I mean, my son has kept me abreast of what the skein of Black History Month speakers out where he teaches in central Illinois has been like. And it's George Martin, who I saw just got himself suspended from CNN for tweeting arguably homophobic moronisms during the Super Bowl, and Kevin Powell, whose main distinction was being the black guy in the first season of MTV's The Real World, and the running account that he's given me of these talks they give is that they all seem to follow a standard format, which is a little tap dance of Newt Gingrich style erudition, which is to say, and I think this is Krugman's phrase originally, that he talks like stupid people's idea of what smart people sound like. Yeah, but that kind of display, and then followed by expressions of racial bona fides that have to do with one version or another of keeping it real, and then that slides into disparagement of bad black cultural values, and then the moral of uplift. And these performances draw 10 to 15 grand. I mean, at a minimum, in the five figures. Like I said, they're all prepackaged and standardized, and it's really performance in the same way that the Tea Party festivities are performances. There's a quality of wrestling about them.
Of course, there you go for proof of racism, because I think John Huntsman gets about $30,000 a speech, and who in God's name would want to listen to him?
Though how it goes with the likes of Huntsman and Gingrich, I mean, don't forget, like, you got $1.6 million as a historian for Fannie Mae. This is like a nice game that crowd plays, right? Like the $2 million book advance for a book you know is never going to sell anything. I mean, it just becomes a convenient prop for laundering the money. Because I can't imagine who would want to pay a quarter to hear what Huntsman has to say.
Going back to that,
is he still in a race, by the way?
I believe he's dropped out and endorsed some other lunatic. I can't remember which one.
Well, it seems it would have to be Romney, right? Because wasn't one of his problems that he was Romney light, basically?
That's a redundancy I can't even contemplate.
right.
But going back to the bit about black cultural pathologies, it always plays well with a certain audience when the moneyed and the celebrated play that game. How do you read that? What's that all about?
Well, I mean, a refrain that's been running through my mind a lot as I've been chained to the computer of late is that in a class society, there's no politics that's not a class politics of some sort or another. And I think the more that people protest that their politics isn't a class politics, the more nakedly and transparently it is. Right. And in that sense, it's not distinct to black Americans by any means. Right. Rogers Brubaker examines the processes according to which ethnicity becomes politicized in Central Europe, where his field sites are. But he makes this point in general that ethnic identity is likely to become a political domain when some small group of people wants to pursue agendas that require the support of a much larger group of people than those who could ever hope to benefit from the agenda. And then that's when it's convenient for a small first-person plural to get fronted off as a big first-person plural. And there's the history of nationalism, as it were, right? Writ large and writ small. And in this instance, I mean, this narrative of black pathology and cultural inadequacy has been a feature of black nationalism for as long as there's been something described as black nationalism. And I want to give a plug to Dean Robinson's book, Black Nationalism in American Politics and Thought, because it's, I think, the most cogent study that's ever been done of black nationalism as an historical ideology. And for that reason, by and large, it doesn't get cited by people who want to make up a lot of stuff that they feel good about. But you're going back to the late 19th century with people like Alexander Crummell and other heroes of what's sometimes called classical black nationalism, the impulse to emigrate and to found an all-black black society someplace was from the beginning connected with the civilizing mission, right? That Western or American blacks who've been cultivated and Christianized would go take Christianity and cultivation to Liberia and wherever else they'd get their hooks. It was also true, a narrative of the empirical population's failure to live up to the aestheticized racial ideas or ideals for it, right, was a staple of Garveyism. It was a staple of certainly of black power ideology in the 60s and the 70s, especially as it took the shape of black cultural nationalism. And I think a significant moment there actually was and remains the ambivalent new reaction that the strain of black nationalists of this sort or race-conscious piles of this sort took to the Moynihan Report on the Negro Family, in that they accepted the criticism of black cultural pathology, but they just didn't want it coming from a white guy. And to roll the tape forward, right, now stop lightly just by noting William Julius Wilson's Underclass or Tangle of Pathologies, which is a notion he even took from Kenneth Clark around the same time as the Moynihan Report. But this is what, this is a consistent line about what ghettoization does. It creates these cultural pathologies, and therefore we need to have equality to help combat the cultural pathologies. And then by the time you get to the 80s and 90s, much louder than their ranks ever warranted cohort of black neocons, after loudly trumpeting and widely broadcast claims that liberals don't want to face up to the damage that racism has caused and what people need to do to take responsibility, has, by the time you get to Clinton, that becomes like the black racial orthodoxy. So that first, and I'll shut up after this, but the first you see in the Clinton administration, the president's habit of going before black audiences, all black audiences, ideally in churches and the like, to deliver what were in effect stern rebukes to black people that they need to clean up. It becomes, by 2008, the basis on which Obama is able to establish his racial bona fides. That of course never won some primaries. To black audiences like the NAACP and others, right? So the fact that he gets a standing ovation from the NAACP and from people in various churches for casting lamentations onto the backs of mute black poor people. And, even Glenn Greenwald and Katrina VandenHeuvel kind of slurped him after he gave the Popeye's chicken speech for making the unorthodox move of attacking black poor people, right? So, I guess that's kind of where we are now. But again, I guess I should end this by saying, that's a class program, right? That's a class politics. And it's the same class politics that was present in the Million Man March, which seemed like, it would seem kind of schizophrenic on first glance, because it was, as a friend of mine said, it looked like an instance of a bunch of people coming together to launch a protest against themselves. But I think that moment shows clearly how slippery that first-person plural thing can be, right? Because it's one first-person plural showing up to make a statement that the stereotypes aren't true, and then pointing to another first-person plural or component of the first-person plural to tell them to stop acting out the stereotypes.
I'm Sukhath Adolf Reed, who is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. No, but psychoanalyze for a moment the people who did that standing ovation. Has their narcissism been flattered, and that's why they're so exuberant?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like doing that at long distance, but it certainly feels to me like that's what's going on. Because, yeah, I mean, it feels like, you know, the process is you validate your own status going in two directions, right? One, through adopting the posture of leading or conducting a tutorial for the race, basically, by being a role model. And the other is that by being in that position, you validate your own accomplishments, right? So your own status success, I suppose, would be a way to put it. But it's, and I mean, as my friend Ken Warren has argued, from one perspective, a driving force of black elite political discourse since 1895 has been contestation for managerial authority over the nation's race problem, as he described it. Right, I mean, that's a logic, right? And, I mean, you can see that, you know, all the disparity in, you know, literature and all the yes-but racism trumps everything, undercuts every attempt to do anything. You can't do anything before you combat racism. From the perspective that Warren suggests, it looks a lot like a class program that has its material roots in the politics of racial representation. And any notion to suggest, right, any inclination to suggest that race, which technically speaking doesn't cause anything, lies at the source of whatever injustice or inequality black Americans experience is itself, I think, an insistence or a patrolling of the boundaries of the race relations management industry.
Switching to a not unrelated topic, an old antagonist of yours, Charles Murray, is now catching some headlines for going into the pathology of the white working class, in some sort of affirmative action move. What do you make of this new celebrity that Murray has achieved?
Well, that is not enough to drive a stake in the heart and cut the head off, because they keep coming back. Murray, in the first place, this new line isn't really even a new line for Murray, because part of his sibilant pornographic racism was always sounding the warning that this cultural pathology was as likely as not to start infecting whites also, and he's been counting the spread of these pathologies for a long time. Although I have to say that one of my favorite Charles Murray interventions was an op-ed piece that I think he had in the Tribune. I know that I saw it when I was still living in Chicago. I think it may have been after the bell curve, maybe. He did an op-ed piece in which he blamed real estate development and the explosion of construction of efficiency and one-bedroom apartments in cities in the late 50s and the early 60s for the decay of the American family, because by giving women access to comparatively cheap rents, it enabled women who were unhappy or in abusive relationships to leave instead of, getting the boxing gloves and staying in there and fighting it out on their own. So, that's Murray. I mean, I think the way you put the question is really best, because the question isn't really about Murray, because he is a one-trick pony who just does, or I'd say a one-trick viper who just does what he does. But it's, what accounts for his getting, the public prop every decade or so. And I think part of it is that he's well-funded and he's well-think-tanked. And, I mean, it's also, the fact that at this moment, whatever we would call this wing of the bourgeoisie, I mean, they're not really a ruling class because they don't rule, really, and they certainly don't rule in the interest of the class as a whole, or much less in even a perverted notion of the interest of the society as a whole. But this sort of plunderocracy, or whatever you want to call them, and the not-so-crypto fascist lunatics who make up a lot of their active base are just prepared to write off bigger and bigger sections of the population, you know, the losers, in exactly the same kind of racialized way that they would write off, you know, those who happen to check a different you know, race box on their birth certificates. And you know, that's not new either, right? I mean, that's always been, right? I mean, that's been for at least 150 years, right, or longer, you know, the way the ruling class has operated, right? And that's one of the problems, I think, with putting so much stock on race and not seeing race or racialist ideology as a subset of a larger genus of ascriptive ideologies of hierarchy that you know, justify grinding chunks of the population under, you know, into the dust. And you know, I'm not going to read the Murray book. I mean, I've you know, I read the bell curve. That's it. Punto. I'm done. Right. Right. I mean, Charles Murray. But I've read every word of the bell curve, and I figured that insulates me, you know, against having to read another word by Murray. I noticed that you know, David Brooks, as you know, always, is prepared to be Murray's you know, among Charles Murray's press agents, as he is, you know, for Steve Saylor and a lot of other nasty bastards. But
he gives it the kind of coding that makes it acceptable to the NPR demographic.
Yes, no, absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, he's found that niche, right? I mean, I've got to give him credit for that, because he's the reasonable-seeming conservative. And I don't understand why that is, right? Because it's a little bit like the kind of middle-brow thing you got from Buckley, isn't it? Although without the campiness. But, I mean, there's a way of feigning. I mean, George Will does this kind of too, right? You feign an intellectual reserve and a ponderousness. And it seems like more and more, Doug, and I think this in the classroom too, I've come close to saying it, that posturing is like all we get anymore, right? There's no content out there anymore. And I know this sounds like an old man's rant, but the only thing that matters seems to be the package. And Brooks trades on that, but I don't know. I mean, you have a better theory of why people who ought to see Brooks as a brown shirt don't?
Well, I think one thing might be that now that we've seen inequality interjected into the political discourse in a way that might make some people uncomfortable, Murray and Brooks get a chance to shift the discourse to the realm of culture where they feel more comfortable and where you don't have to talk about redistribution.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I just saw yet another one of those puts him from the Chicago Econ Department, Casey Mulligan, I think his name is, in the Times Economics blog. And I don't know why I bothered to look at this, but explaining about how costly the social safety net is, and actually, you know, suggesting not quite asserting openly, but suggesting that, you know, we might want to consider that everybody would be better off if, instead of giving that money to what he puts in, you know, scare quotes, the poor, and if you didn't take that money from the other people to give it to them, then they might use it to, you know, and that's about when I stopped reading that one, too, because you figure what the laundry list is going to be, right?
Well, yeah, we're now calling the rich job creators, so by taking money from the job creators, we're assuring that unemployment will stay high.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
It was news to me that the unemployment insurance system was funded by rich people.
Yes, I didn't quite know that one either. But actually, I got a question for you now you know, on this. I mean, and it may not be fair to turn the tables, but when I read the article in the Times this morning about the administrative tweaking of the unemployment insurance system to modernize it, of course, I suspected that modernize was going to mean what it always means. And I was struck, first of all, that the Times was quite open about saying that one benefit that would come from this would be reducing unemployment, while explaining that what it meant by reducing unemployment means in this context is basically juking the stats. But the other thing that struck me about it was that a component of this is shifting some of the fund from direct payments to unemployed recipients to subsidize employers, and I'm sure it would have to be low wage employers to hire people, so that would seem to be both a version of what Clinton did with TANF, which was in effect shift the subsidy from from the poor people directly to employers of low-wage labor. But it also seems to me that a net effect of this would likely be to lower the reservation wage.
Yeah, well, it's also rather like the earned income tax credit, which, although it gets money into the hands of the working poor, is also a subsidy to low-wage employment. So it seems like that social policy now seems to be to subsidize employers to hire poor folks instead of using the state to shift money into the pockets of poor folks directly. It has to go through the employer, forcing poor people to work more unpleasant jobs at lower wages. That seems to be the goal of social policy.
Yeah, and that's why the convict lease system so popped into my head when I read that. But yeah, all right. So it's finally blending outdoor relief and the poorhouse, like in a way that gives the advantages of both, I suppose, right?
All right, so let's wrap this up. Speaking of the liberals, who will endorse just about anything now that this is a year divisible by four, we now see, of course, you know, the Republican campaign is a horrific spectacle, and I will not deny that for a second. But we're seeing... Now, the unions have already come around a couple of months earlier than I thought they might. I thought they might have held out for a little longer. One despairs upon on our political options. We have a choice between an absolutely insane party and a party that will more or less sanely conduct drone attacks and subsidize Wall Street. What are our political options to get out of this, if any, to get out of this Hobson's choice?
Yeah, well, Doug, you know me. I mean, but and I will say that I have never felt as rudderless as I do at this moment. Right? I mean, the left is absolutely hopeless and useless to be non-existent, and I mean the capacity for critical political imagination has gone, and I think has completely evaporated. And I think probably three decades of activism have dealt the ultimate blow. It's funny. My son and I were talking about this morning, that because he said that he's already stopped paying attention to the Republican campaign dynamics, because he said, look, like it's going to be some version of the combination of Santorum, Gingrich, and Romney, probably in Romney's body. We know how it's going to play out, because once again, Obama has been able to get the perfect opposition for him. I mean, I've been saying for 2 or 3 weeks now that if I were the Obama campaign, I wouldn't do anything except tape all the campaign speeches that the Republicans give and just run them as ads after the nominating conventions, and it'll be like the little girl picking daisies in '64. So obviously, I mean, the liberals have, and what I'm now calling the internet fundraising left, all are deeply invested in stoking our fears and anxieties about these clowns. I mean, these fascist clowns over there, right on the Republican side. And yeah, I mean, there's nothing to vote for except Obama. But the story is the same that it's been for a half century now, at least, that we've got to have a politics that looks beyond and outside the election cycle, and nobody seems capable of doing that anymore. And, I mean, there's nothing that's going to happen in 2012, and I don't see the basis. There's some interesting little nodes of occurrences out there, like the agreement that Sal Roselli and the National Union of Healthcare Workers and the Machinists just entered into is something that might have some potential, especially if it can go beyond the sound of left syndicalism. But no, in 2012, I mean, there's not going to be any choice other than slow or fast death for most of the stuff that most of us are concerned about. As between the two, it's like a cancer diagnosis, right? Slow is better than rapid, right? But look at at Obama's announcement today, right? That he wants to reduce the corporate tax rate to 28%. And the thing that's striking about the liberal and leftoid defenders is an inability to connect dots, right, between actions in one domain and impact and impact of actions in another domain. That seems that it has to be willful, or they're just stupid. I don't know which it is, or caught up in a religious frenzy, which is like a long-winded way of saying stupid. But no, I think we're just screwed, right? And I don't see any end in sight. I don't see any challenge in sight. And I mean, all I have to say about, you know, on that front is, yeah. I mean, how about that Occupy stuff? And I know there's going to be a lot of calls for faith in things as yet unseen, what it could catalyze down the road, the forces that are out there percolating that you don't know anything about. But, you know, one problem with, you know, being on the left for what's closing in on a half century now, alas, is you've heard this story, like, so many times, over and over and over and over again about, what's coming, right? That ship that's not quite visible on the horizon, but I know it's there and it's going to show up with the fabulous cargo. And that's kind of where we are. And until we can break out of that kind of stuff and, you know, disconnect and begin to think about politics as a more strategic activity that doesn't live through the public action and is not about self-expressiveness and personal fulfillment and expression of one's identity as an activist, I think we're going to be screwed in the same way. And I just don't, I despair of how bad things stand to get, with no counterweight, and there is no counterweight, so.
This is why you don't get the speaking invitations or the cable TV shows.
Oh, well. But I have good friends and comrades I can trust.
Thanks, Adolf.
That was Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of One Life to Leave, a Requiem by Outhud, a band that was formed in Berkeley in 1996 and then relocated to Brooklyn, where they broke up in 2005. Till next week, bye.
And when you're swept to sea, there's people like me, and then there's people like you. We don't see evil, they don't know what they do, tiny and few. And when you're swept to sea, there's people like me.